So welcome all to this week's Q&A session. Guests, as always, are welcome. If you want to join, I pasted it into the chat link you can go to join the group. It's only $20 a year. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome everyone. And first up, I just want to remind you of the kind of meeting format that we have these days. And you'll recall for the last couple of meetings, we've been trying to get through the prepared presentations and leave the last 10 minutes or so for ad hoc questions. And that's the plan tonight, so we'll see how we do. So think about questions you want to ask. You can either put them in the chat, and we'll monitor the chat as we go along, and then come back to the questions later. Or when we get to the other questions, you can open your mic and ask the crew directly anything that you wish to know. So we'll get to that in about 40 minutes, I guess, hopefully. Okay, so to start with, I have a quick follow-up from last week where I was complaining that my Acer Aspire netbook, my old Steam-driven computer, wouldn't connect to the modem. And Chris had suggested rebooting the modem, and I said, well, I couldn't possibly do that because in my house we have a Supreme S. Everybody probably knows that SU in Linux is the super user. In my house we have the Supreme user, otherwise known as the spousal unit. And when the Supreme user is watching tennis, I'm not allowed to reboot the modem. However, she went out the next morning, so I rebooted the Bell modem, and lo and behold, my netbook connected automatically in both Linux and Windows. So clearly that was the problem. So the answer is listen to Chris, and if all else fails, reboot your system, either your modem or your computer, or both. And that will probably make things work.
Well, you hope anyway.
The neat little graphic, Chris actually provided that to me, and he clearly is now a graphic artist, and he's going to tell us how he did it.
Thanks, Alan. So I came across this a while ago, DALL-E 2, and it's put out by the folks at OpenAI. And they describe it as an AI system that can create realistic images and art from a description in natural language. So basically just type in what it is you want them to draw and they draw it for you. So you can create a free account on their site. It does have a limited number of free uses per month, but there doesn't seem to be any limit to the number of email addresses you can use. And I think the first month you can get something like 30, and then subsequent months it's like 10 or something like that per month. Anyway, basically you go there and you do a natural language description of what it is you want them to draw for you, and then you download your finished unique, and I put in quotes, artwork. So the URL is at the bottom where you can create the account, and you go to that same URL later on to log in as well. So next. So here was an example I did where I said abstract pencil and watercolor art of a sad computer mouse. And it always comes up with four examples for you. And so this is what it came up with. It's kind of interesting, and you can download any of them just by clicking a dot, dot, dot in the top right-hand corner of each of the images, and you'll have a download option on it. So next. So I wanted to see, can it actually replace use of clip art? So I use a lot of clip art for presentations, and I use FabPNG, which I really, really like. I actually have a premium account there, which is lifetime for $40 or something like that, and you can do unlimited downloads. If you have a free account, you're limited to two a day. So they have a lot of really good clip art, and there are lots of other free and paid clip art sites that you can go to get pretty good quality clip art. So you can also just do an image search at Google, and I always advise people to check the usage rights and obligations. So during your search, you can actually go and say you want only things that are under a Creative Commons license, which is basically free to use. But Creative Commons sometimes does require attribution to legally use it, so just keep that in mind. Next. So one of the things that I thought was kind of neat is the DALL-E 2 output is unique. If you give the same instructions repeatedly, you'll actually get different results on it. And so you do get truly unique images that will come out of it. Your output is always going to be 1,000 by 1,000 pixel PNG files. And yeah, I find it's kind of interesting. So next. So here's a piece of clip art that I got off of FabPNG that I have used for Q&A before. November 2nd was the last time, just a laughing emoji. Next. So I went to DALL-E 2 and I said, laughing my ass off cartoon. And they didn't like that. So it says, looks like this request may not follow our content policy. So I guess it was they don't like the word ass. So I changed it to cartoon laughing smiley emoji. And it came up with four that I thought, yeah, kind of interesting. Next. Then I had this other thing I got off of FabPNG of a bursting hard drive. So full of files that, you know, you're going to want to do something about or whatever to illustrate that. So I thought, can I get something representative of that? So next. So I said, first off, a pencil drawing of a hard drive bursting with files. And, yeah. Some sort of, not really great, and that doesn't evoke exactly the same thing, but kind of interesting. Next. Then I tried a color pencil sketch of a hard drive stuffed with too many files, and it came up with different things. Still nothing really along the line of the FabPNG image that was up there, but still kind of interesting and maybe useful under certain circumstances. Next. Then I tried just a more mundane thing, and I said, sketch of a woman walking on the beach with a dog. And actually, I thought that all four of them were actually very, very good representations of that particular phrase. Next. Then I tried something a little bit more wacko, a blue whale playing the piano in the style of Picasso. And so, again, it comes up with four, and it was just kind of interesting what it can come up with, something really off the wall. Next. So one of the things bothers me about DALL-E 2 is that it tends to cut off things at the edge of the frame. So this one was computer mouse puzzling, but what's on the screen cartoon. And you can see that the one on the right I wasn't too happy with, but the left one and the middle one, I thought they were kind of interesting, but they were sort of chopped off, and it would be really nice if they actually included the entire mouse or the entire screen and things like that. So next, I decided to try, well, what if I put it in a wooden frame? And I thought that maybe the frame would be captured and then everything within it would be visible and I'd be able to get that. But what they interpreted that to be was the wooden frame was the monitor as opposed to just a wooden frame around the image itself. So, but kind of interesting, you know, and in actual fact, a little bit less chopped off. Certainly the left-hand one, all four of them actually, they don't really chop off the what to me was the important essence of what I was trying to get at on that. So I tried again, and I decided a framed cartoon of a computer mouse puzzling about what's on the screen. And that didn't really work out either. The left one certainly gave me with very little chopped off. But, you know, it's a little bit of a challenge, I find, to get things that the main subject is not partly chopped off at the edge of the frame. Next.
Before you go on, Chris, a question. Does somebody actually draw these?
No. It's all done by AI. And so you'll get your results in typically about 10 seconds.
Okay, that was the second part. How long did it take?
Yeah. So after doing that, I happened across this other thing, Google Imagen Work Drawbench, and it's currently in a sort of formative stage. It's not open for regular users, but what they claim is they have unprecedented photorealism and deep level of knowledge, language understanding. So they claim that human beings rate the Imagen output over other models, including DALL-E 2. In sample quality, as well as alignment with what it is you actually ask for. Next. And here's some examples, and you can see like they're actually pretty detailed. You know, so the left one, teddy bear swimming at the Olympics 400 meter butterfly event. So it's obviously a teddy bear. It seems obvious that it's doing the butterfly, and it's in an Olympic pool. You know, pretty good alignment, very good quality image. The middle one, the Android mascot, everybody knows what that looks like as the standard green thing, but made from bamboo. And nice shadow on it, nice vignette around the edge, quite well done. And then the last one I really had to laugh at, an art gallery displaying Monet paintings. The art gallery is flooded. Robots are going around the art gallery using paddle boards. These are all just sample images. I didn't type these in. I can't actually direct it at this point in time. So right now it is a research project. They hope to open it up to users at some point, whether it's going to be a paid service or free, who knows. But if you're interested in this sort of thing, keep in touch with Google Imagen. And by all means, try out the DALL-E 2. It's a lot of fun. And it's free. So that's what I got on there.
Another question, Chris. Do the images stay on the site or do they disappear after you close the app?
They actually do stay on the site. I don't know for how long, but if I go on now, I can. I'm not sure if I see right back to the beginning of when I was doing it, which is about 2 weeks ago, I guess, I first started using it. But I've got probably about 25 sets there, and each of them are four. So I've got about 100 images that are on the site that I can now access and download. I'm presuming that they're going to disappear at some point. I think what they're doing is they're keeping it around to improve their algorithms. So, you know, if they get, you know, a bunch of things asking for a sad computer mouse, you know, they could look and see what the algorithm has put out so far and fine-tune things to improve stuff. So I presume that that's why they're keeping it around. The other thing is that they are very clear that you do own copyright to that, the images, in that you actually, I'm not sure if it's really total copyright, but you have total freedom of use for free. So there's no licensing issues in using these images. And because they're totally unique, it's great. You know, you have no qualms about using it anywhere you want to, and it's not going to exist anywhere else.
It's really, really neat, neat program.
Yeah, it's fun. It really is.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So moving along, I have a really brief computer basics item. And it's kind of an annoyance in Windows, basically when you want to move a window on the screen, I kind of grab hold of the display bar at the top here, and I drag the window, and if I happen to hit the top, then suddenly, boom, the window snaps to the edge and basically fills the screen. So I really hate that. I guess I'm blaming Windows, but actually, Linux will do exactly the same thing. But it turns out in both operating systems, you can turn this snap behavior off. And in Windows, it's pretty easy. You just go to the settings menu, pick on display, and look for the multitasking option in the sidebar here. And when you do that, you'll find that you've got a whole bunch of things that you can tell Snap to do with these windows. But basically, my preference is to take the on and slide it to off, and that solves all of my problems. And that's all I really have.
Mm-hmm.
Chris has another issue with Windows.
Yeah.
He's going to tell us all about it.
Yeah, this should have been labeled as being one of my rants, I guess. So I have a desktop computer that is capable of running Windows 11. So it's an 8th gen Core i7. It's got enough memory. It's got all of the specs. When I go into the Windows update, it actually tells me Windows 11 is ready and it's free and I can download and install. And it says that I'm up to date, which is presumably on my Windows 10, tells me that I'm up to date. I don't really want Windows 11 yet, so I just left that there, and I just keep letting it run Windows Update, and it keeps telling me that I'm up to date. Next. Well, actually, I'm not up to date, because I happened to notice that my laptop was actually at 22H2, and I looked at the system about on my desktop computer, and it tells me that I'm at 21H1. So I'm actually like a year and a half out of date. So I'm not up to date. So next. So at some point I just decided, well, what happens if I decide to click on the stay on Windows 10 for now? And if I click on that, immediately it does a check for updates. Next. And it happily comes back and tells me, feature update to Windows 10 version 22H2 is now available and you can download and install it. So it was hiding this feature update from me, I guess hoping that I was going to go for Windows 11 rather than just merely going up to 22H2. So it hid that from me. I was still getting security updates and so forth, but I wasn't getting that feature update. Next. So it was actually a very, very quick update. I don't know what the heck that update is from 21H1 to 22H2, but it was done in less than 5 minutes. And I came back into Windows Update, and I clicked on Check for Updates, and it says I'm up to date. So I thought, well, really, am I? Next. And if I check on the system and about, I am now on 22H2. So, yes, indeed, I am up to date now. Next. So the lesson learned is if you have a computer that is Windows 11 capable and you're being prompted to say, oh, you can get Windows 11 just by clicking on here. And if you don't want Windows 11, check that or click on that link that's in that box that says stay on Windows 10 for now, and that'll ensure that you get all the latest updates for your Windows 10.
Amazing. Who knew that you had to do that?
I certainly didn't.
Tim wants to know if that's kind of a bait and switch deal because they're clearly wanting you to update to 11 and not telling you about the feature updates to Windows 10.
Yeah. That's just stupid. Microsoft, what the hell are you up to?
Well, you've got one happy camper here. Somebody, Natalie's going, he's on the 21H22, so she's going to do that. And the screen as well, there you go.
Hang on a second. Chris was saying he was on 21H1.
Yeah, right, but I was, but 21H2 is still a year out of date, and I'd be willing to bet if Natalie checks up or clicks on that link saying stay on Windows 10 for now, she'll be offered 22H2 as well.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear from Natalie if that's the case. I'm suspecting, Chris, you're bang on.
I was really, really very surprised by that.
I'm not going to bet against you.
And I was wondering why I wasn't offered, because I knew I was on 21H1, and I just sort of put off that. It's like, oh, they probably have a block on one piece of hardware that I've got or something like that, that they're waiting for updated drivers. And I just sort of put it off. And it was just when I noticed that my laptop was at 22H2, I said, hey, hang on a second. My desktop should be more up to date than it is. And I stumbled across that. I just, yeah. Anyways, Natalie, let us know what it says.
And I'll just point out that if your machine won't update to Windows 11, you don't have a problem. Okay, thanks, Chris. And moving along, Tom has some sage advice for us under the Windows hood. So you're going to share your screen, Tom, and unmute your microphone?
Yes, I shall. Okay, let's share the screen. And I want this one. Okay, there are a variety of utilities from SysInternals, which has been taken over by Microsoft, and it's available on a Microsoft site. But one of these utilities is called Process Explorer, and it's useful. I use it basically as a replacement for a Task Manager, because firstly, it's I can put some graphs in the taskbar, and so it's immediately available. I just have to click on it, and it allows me to look at processes, all the things that are running. I can change things, so it shows you what's running, and you can go into great detail if you want, which is mainly useful for developers. It'll also give you a lot of information about all these processes, so you can have it in a tabular display, and you can choose from many columns, and you can move them, you can sort them. It's great. You can also check the running processes versus virus total. So that'll give you a vote on whether there's a virus in there. It's not perfect. Virus total sometimes thinks that privately signed things are not kosher, but you usually know that those are okay. At least I do for my processes. And it allows you to see and edit the priority and kill processes, which is handy at times. It shows you graphs and numbers. It's Task Manager on steroids. There is a 42-minute video on Process Explorer. It's from 2012, but the link is there. And it goes through all the details, and they haven't changed that much in the last 10 years. It's gotten into more details, and it's good for Windows 10 as well as for Windows XP. And the taskbar icons, which you can see there at the bottom right, show the percentage usage. So there's a graph, and you can see them kind of enlarged crazily. And you can choose which icons are shown, but it shows your CPU, GPU, your RAM, your network, your disk. It can also show you commits and so on. Go to the next one. So it can show you a graphical summary, which shows you the usage of your CPU, system commits, physical memory, I/O, network disk, and sort of how it's been using. You can also dig down deeper. That's the summary, and on the right is the just the CPU, and you can see where it's what's being used. The red is actually Windows innate processes, i.e. the OS. The green is actually the user processes, the applications. And I right-clicked on where at the left corner of that that box here. It says the CPU is 77.73%. Proc Explorer 64. It gives you the process ID 28216 and the time, but you can go through and you can just move your mouse over that and see what's being used, what's using your CPU, or if you use any of the other graphs, what's using your data or network or whatever. And this is the tabular display. You get the mini graphs at the top, that shows you some of the things. As you can tell from the scroll bar, there's lots and lots of processes. So it tells you what they are. This is the virus total that you can look at, and it's I've sorted by this. SMSS is verified. It tells you what has been signed. And it's scanning there because I have no idea why. Squirrel is a William Gibson thing. But there's a lot of, you can see a variety of programs here. These are the ones that have not been, although they're verified, the signature is valid. There's one or more virus checkers in virus total that thinks some of these are kind of iffy or there's something in them that they don't like. So all these columns, you can choose which to display. There are a lot of columns to choose from. You can sort them up or down, and you get these mini graphs at the top, as well as you have a graph of the CPU's history. You can get a graph of several different histories, including, I think, I/O. These are private bytes, so this is what each program uses privately. The working set is kind of the minimum number of bytes that it uses, that it needs to run for each of these programs. So onwards and neckwards, upwards, not neckwards. So you can view or control the programs. If you just cursor over, you can see the command line and the path to the that was used to start this. This is my Pegasus mail, which is why there's a Pegasus here. You can right click to do a variety of things. You can open the window, go to the window. You can set the priority. You can kill the process. Delete key also does this. You can restart the process and suspend it. I actually tried using restart, but it starts it under the wrong ID. If you're using your, if you're running administrator mode, it starts it under the wrong ID and everything is messed up. So don't do that. You can debug it, which I have never done. You can create a dump, which I presume is mini or maxi. And you can check virustotal.com just on that one process. Check it again or check it to see if anything's changed. You can see its properties and you can search online whether there's anything online about that particular program. I'm going through the particular menus here. This is the file menu. And as you can see, you can save the state. You can run a program. You can run as a limited user. I'm running actually Process Explorer as administrator here, as you can see up here. It doesn't have to, you don't have to. You can run it as a standard user, but I usually run it as a standard user, but I'm running it as administrator for this particular presentation. You can run a program as an administrator, or you can run it as a limited user. I presume if you're running Process Explorer as a limited user, then these would be reversed. You can also shut down the complete computer, or you just exit Process Explorer. Options, you can run it log on, which I do. I want it to show up with its little icons in my taskbar. You can verify the image. I've chosen to verify the image signature, so that's done when it starts up. Virus total, you can check the virus total and you can click submit unknown executables, which basically does that right away. And if you click this on and off, it checks all of them all again. So, but ordinarily it's sort of what's being done when you're doing it, when you're running Process Explorer. You can hide it when minimized as opposed to, for example, that then it goes to the taskbar as opposed to a little window. There's a variety of things here. You can configure the colors. The colors are a variety of things, including the line that you're looking at. This is this guy. You can also, when things change, when a new process starts or an old process ends, if it ends, it turns to red. If it starts, it turns to green. And you can specify duration. I think I've specified 10 seconds. You can also specify the font. And I haven't used theme. I presume you can go to a dark mode if you want. The view. This is the system information. Now that's the system information gets you the graphs that you see here. As you can see, system information. You can go to the process tree. That shows you in a kind of indented thing all the other processes that are under here. So this is these. Anyway, I'm not sure what column heat maps are. You can scroll to new processes. That means when there's a new process, it automatically shows up in the window when you are using the window and the new process starts. This I haven't used at all. You can show processes from all users, which I do. You can set the opacity, so you can actually have this as a transparent window or pane that goes over what you're usually doing. The lower pane, you can put a lower pane on Process Explorer, and in this lower pane you can show DLLs, handles, or threads. Each process usually has one or more threads that are going at the same time. You can refresh, and that sort of goes along with update speed. You can set the update refresh speed from 0.5 to 10 seconds, or you can pause it. And if you pause it, then refresh now lets you change it right away. So it's updated. Organized column sets. You can have different sets of columns. All of these, the things that are here. All of these columns, you can save them. And so you can use a variety of sets of columns that you use for different purposes. And going onwards. A process, if you get into a process, this is a process menu, you can set the priority, and these are the choices, but do not use priorities over 10 for ordinary applications. You'll see if you use Process Explorer that things like the window manager and a variety of internal Windows things use these higher processes. For your apps and so on, if you want to increase something that you want to be more responsive, then you would choose like something like above normal. If you want something to just go around in the background using up CPU and I/O whenever nothing else is happening, then you choose background. You can kill a process. The delete key also does this. You can restart the process and suspend the process, but again, I don't recommend doing this because it starts it in the wrong context as a different user. Debug, create dump, you can check the virus total. A lot of these things are available as right clicks for a process as well. You can also see the properties of a process, and you can search online for the process. As for process details, I've put a few windows here kind of overlap. And you can see the kind of thing that happens. This is the image tab of a process properties, and it says the path and a whole bunch of other stuff. The performance, the CPU, working set, etc., all the performance things. The performance graph, you can get a graph. It has private bytes, hasn't had much CPU. There's not much I/O. You can see the disk access. I'm sorry, I didn't show what thing this is, but you can see that there are a variety of things. This is a security thing. So group, this is the group it's in and what its privileges are. And you can also see the particular threads within the process. And I found this useful sometimes when I find a problem with some kind of app or program. And especially you see a whole bunch of cycles here, like millions. you can report this, take a screenshot, and send it off to the particular app developer and tell them, hey, you know, this has gotten stuck. That may be helpful to the developer. There's a variety of other things you can do, environment, strings, et cetera, et cetera. But that's it. That's what I use Process Explorer mainly as a, you know, fancy task manager. I use it mainly to edit the priority, to kill processes if they're stuck, to see the resource usage or bottlenecks by process or in the task tray, and to check for viruses or hanging processes, which I may kill. And you can report the developers, which shall process got stuck. It's invaluable for developers, for the ordinary user. It's mainly for kind of problems that show up or for taking a look and seeing what's happening and why things are slow. Are there any questions?
Yeah, there weren't any questions, Tom, but there are a couple of, well, first of all, anybody who's interested in more information, Tom's deck will be available on the website probably tomorrow. There are a couple of links in the chat window. Joss and Chris both put links in to various associated things. And Chris notes that Process Explorer is written by Mark Vucinovich, who is a well-known author of a lot of useful Windows utilities. Okay, thanks very much, Tom, and we look forward to part two, I guess. And in the meantime, I just note that Natalie has confirmed, in fact, that her Windows update was reporting that it was on the earlier update, but when she clicked on the stay on Windows 10, then the option for 22H2 feature update became available. So thanks, Chris, for that. It certainly has helped Natalie out and several other people, I believe. And now Chris has got another tip, a share for a new Microsoft toy.
Yeah, everybody knows, I think, that I'm a big fan of the Power Toys. They're a free set of utilities that come out of Microsoft. They are constantly revised and new toys added and so forth. They're free of charge, installed on Windows 10 and 11. And I found quite a few of them to be very useful. A couple of weeks ago, they came out with a new Power Toy called File Locksmith. So if you've ever gone to eject a flash drive, this is just an example of how it can be used. And so you go to the tray icon, you click on the safely remove icon, and then you get problem ejecting the device, and it says it's currently in use, close any programs or windows that may be using the device, and then try again. And quite often, quite frankly, I cannot find any, you know, program that is actually using it, or I can't see that I've got files open on it or whatever. Next. So the warning is actually a good thing, because it is preventing the possibility of data loss, because some device, some program or process is actively using that device. If you just yank it, who knows what will happen to it. If it's got a file that is being modified that is on that device and it hasn't been saved, you can lead to data loss. Who knows? So it's actually a good idea to give that, but I find that it often can be really difficult to find out what program or window is actually using that particular device. Next. So new in the PowerToys 0.64.0 is File Locksmith. And if you go to the configuration screen for PowerToys, this is all it is. So you go to File Locksmith, you can turn it on, you can turn it off. That's it. And it tells you it's a shell extension, which means that when you're in File Explorer, you can right-click on a file, and you can choose this new option that'll be there, what's using this file. So next. And if I do that on a file where I did have a file open on a flash drive using PowerPoint, and it just comes up and it tells me, yes, PowerPoint.exe is actually using that particular device. Next. So I can just click on End Task, and it'll kill the process, and it'll free it up. Now, it is no better than just pulling the flash drive at that point in time, really, because all you're doing is you're killing the process. You're not giving it a chance to clean up after itself, to save on any unsaved files or anything like that. So basically, you're just, it's the same thing as if you're pulling it, but at least you know what it was that was locking that particular device. Now, it does go a little bit further. So if you click the chevron where it says, you know, what is locking that device, it'll open up a pane and it'll give you some more information. So the process ID, that shows up in Task Manager. If you want to actually look, go and look at the actual process that is doing it, it tells you the user and it tells you what files are open. And in this case, you know, I have on this O drive, which was a flash drive, and it's in particular directory and presentation demo.pptx and the temp file when you open up a PowerPoint file. So it tells you what the documents are and so forth. So you could decide, oh, okay, I don't care about this one, and just yank it. Or it'll give you a chance to go and say, okay, that's an important file. Let me go and I'll close down PowerPoint, closing the file and unlock it that way. Next. So one thing I'll note here is that the user is actually pretty useless. Well, it's totally useless in 64.0 because it does not identify files when they're locked by other users. So the only user you would end up seeing there is yourself. Now, they've improved it. I bugged this with them, and the developers looked at it, and they made some modifications. So in 64.1 of the PowerToys, it is partially fixed in that it'll tell you if the system is the process that is actually locking it, which is the operating system itself, as opposed to a user-started process. But they still haven't gone so far as to say if it's another user that is logged in on your computer, it still doesn't show up showing you that, oh, this other logged-in user has got that file locked open, and maybe you don't want to pull it because you're going to be losing work, you know, that somebody else has opened up. So, getting better, but so I find it actually, it's very useful. So it works on files, folders, and drives to unlock things. So it's not just the instance of having a particular flash drive that you can't eject. It could also be that you go to delete a file and you're told, oh, can't be deleted because it's in use, or you go to delete a folder and it says, you know, we can't delete the folder. You look, it's empty. Why can't it delete it? Because the process has it open. So you can actually have it work on files, folders, and drives, and it'll identify any of the files or folders or whatever, so you can go and close them, or you can kill that process that is locking that file and unlock it that way. Next. To me, it's not ideal, because the only action available is to terminate the program causing the lock, or, you know, you have to go manually and figure out how to close that particular program. So you could still lose data. So I think it might be better if it would just leave the program running and just kill the lock on the file. Now, how that could actually work is that, say you're in Word and you're creating a document, if you use their process, the only thing you could do is kill the process and you lose your work. But if you just kill the lock on the file and then leave the program running, Word is still there with the document. So when you do go back to Word, you could do a save as and you could save it to a new file. You're not going to lose your work. So that would be a better way to do it rather than killing the process. Just kill the lock on the file. So I think locks from other signed in users would be really good to actually detect that and show them. Now, sometimes you're going to find that processes can't be terminated. Viruses could be really a good example of that, where a virus doesn't want to be killed, and so it does everything it can to make sure that you cannot kill that process. Or there could be critical Windows processes that have that particular resource locked, and if it's a critical window process, you're not going to be able to terminate the process either. There could be permissions problems within Windows that would prevent you from actually doing things as well. So, you know, there's a lot of things that it could be improved on. Next. And along comes an improvement, Lock Hunter. So this is another program that is very similar, but it is more full-featured. So it's a free program, and the feature list from the website, everything that is not highlighted in yellow is identical to what is in File Locksmith in the PowerToys. The yellow stuff goes beyond what is found in File Locksmith. So you can delete or copy or rename a locked file. You can delete it at the next operating system restart. So often when Windows will start up and it might actually put a lock onto a file virtually immediately, and then you can't do anything about it. Well, there is a process that is built into Windows that allows Windows to delete a file before Windows itself really starts up. And so this is the one opportunity you have to delete just about any file. So this uses that facility to allow you to delete a file the next time you restart Windows. You can remove the locking process from a hard drive, an entire hard drive. Unload DLLs. So processes can actually call subprocesses. So you, if it's a subprocess, you might be able to kill that subprocess, leaving the main process running. And it can delete files to the recycle bin if you want to be able to get rid of the file, but then restore it if it was a mistake. And the URL is on the screen there. So the way it works is very similar. You right-click a file, folder, or a drive in File Explorer. Next, and you get that what's locking this. This looks fairly similar in that you see what the process is that is actually locking that particular file, folder, or drive. Next. And I suggest that virtually every time if you're doing this, click on the more details and chevron. I would like it that that just defaulted to that, but you have to do it manually. So you do that. And then it'll actually give you a little bit more information. So you do get things like the process ID, you get the program that is actually doing the lock, and you get the actual files. So this is basically all the same information that File Locksmith was actually giving you. Next. So you can just click on the button there that says unlock it, and that will kill the file lock but leave the program running. So that, again, I think is an improvement because if you have an unchanged file or an unsaved file, it does give you an opportunity, even after you kill that file lock, that you could do a save as to another file if you wanted. But it goes even beyond that. And if you click on the other button, you actually get some additional things like deleting stubborn files by delete at X system startup. So that's where if you just can't find a way to actually delete that file at all, choose that, restart Windows, and the file will be gone. Next, you can preserve a copy of the file. So you can unlock it and rename it or unlock it and copy it somewhere else. Next, terminate a locking process. So that is very much like the file locksmith operates, where it just kills the process that has got the lock on it. And then finally, you have delete locking process from disk. And that, I think, could be really useful if you think that a virus is on your system and you just can't get rid of it. That could well be a way of doing it. Also, the delete at next system restart would also handle a virus that is on your system. Next. So I think the PowerToy File Locksmith is good. It's free. It comes with all of the PowerToys. You can't install just some of the PowerToys. You get them all. So for anybody who is using PowerToys, it's there. It's available to you. It no cost. It doesn't use CPU if it's sitting there. It's just an extension into File Explorer. And it handles the most common issues of locked files quite well. But I think Lock Hunter is even better. It's also free. It handles many more situations where you can have locked files or folders or drives, and it can actually see if a file is locked by a different user. It doesn't identify the user, but it actually lets you know that it is locked. And so if you didn't lock it, then it could be some other logged-in user. So the URLs are there, and actually, I didn't paste that in yet, so I got, there we go. The URLs for both PowerToys as well as Lock Hunter are pasted into the chat. So highly encourage people to check them out, and you will find a workaround for the next time you try to delete something that says can't be deleted or eject a flash drive that it says it can't eject. Lock Hunter is probably the best, but PowerToy will handle most common situations. That's it.
Thanks, Chris. I don't believe there were any questions on that. Okay, so we're at the point where we just have about 10 minutes left, so we're going to skip the next couple of items and go straight to the last 10 minutes somewhere right here. Right, so there is a couple of questions already in the pipe. Now I'll just go back to it here. It's from Micheline, and it's about hyperlinks, hypervisors rather. Now I can't find it. Okay, it's in somewhere.
was at 7:35.
Okay. All right, so there are two questions. I guess I'll, if I do this, it probably pulls it up onto the screen, right? So if anybody uses Hyper-V, the Windows Hyper-V virtual machine program, do you have to install another copy of Windows in a Windows virtual, in a Windows Hyper-V virtual machine in order to run an app? I imagine the answer to that is yes.
Yes.
Somebody's saying yes.
Yes, I'm agreeing.
Okay.
I have, long story short, I used to have three servers running on one server host machine. Same principle. And each one of those servers, so let me put it this way. I had a Windows 2016 server host, and it would run three 2016 servers. One was an email server, one was a domain controller, network controller server, and the other one was a file and print server. For each one of those servers, guest servers, I had to run and have licensed a separate Windows Server 2016. Same thing goes for any form of a virtual machine. And Alan can, Alan has more experience on this with Linux. I mean, he can go on to tell you about how he separates his Windows and Linux. Long story short, you have to have the virtual machine is just the software that sets up the environment to run another operating system off the host.
And then the second question there, Lawrence, where are the program files for the virtual machine? Again, my understanding is that, the VirtualBox, at least, it sets up a folder that has all the virtual machines that you run in VirtualBox.
Right.
And then once you run a virtual machine, then you can install the operating system, and you can then install programs. Like you could run Word in Windows on a virtual machine inside Linux, for example.
Right, and then Michelle's point, she's asking if it's saved on the C drive, and if your only drive is the C drive on that host machine, the answer is yes.
But then again, the Hyper-V program, it saves the virtual machine somewhere in a folder on C somewhere.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. The default location is going to be C:\Documents\Hyper-V\Virtual Hard Disks. And
okay,
in there, you'll,
that one.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's going to be on your C drive, and or the same drive as Windows is installed on, and it'll be AVHD or AVHDX files are the actual virtual hard drives that you install the operating system onto.
Okay, and then there's another question right here, which is essentially a question I think that was asked in the members forum, talking about optics and lenses, and what does 3G2P plus IR mean? So if anybody is an optical device wizard, presumably you might know what that is, but personally, I don't know. IR generally means infrared, but otherwise, I have no idea.
That's answered in the forum. The P stands for plastic lenses, and the G stands for glass lenses.
Oh.
Well, lenses are consisted of several elements, because one simple lens does not put the image on there properly. There are a variety of imperfections, chromatic aberrations. They're called aberrations because they're aberrations. The way they correct them is by putting different elements in. And
that's saying that it has three glass and two plastic elements?
That's right.
Okay.
And that plastic works okay, but the lenses on the outside are better to be glass because they're stronger, sturdier, harder, and they put up with more abuse than plastic lenses do.
Okay, well, that answers that one satisfactorily, I think. Thank you very much, Tom. And I don't see anything new, Chris?
Nope, I don't see anything new either.
I can share a recent tale of angst from a colleague.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I've been reading about this, and long story short is that Dell, though I understand HP2, but most of the discussion has been on Dell. And what they do is they sell you a laptop with Windows, in this case, Windows 11 Home. And Dell decided that, oh, this would be great to install BitLocker on that same machine. So you get it pre-installed from the factory with BitLocker, which is the Microsoft's encryption program. The problem is that, well, someone, Dell, Microsoft, we're not sure who, is supposed to tell you that they have BitLocker on this drive and the key can be found through your Microsoft account. So back to my colleague's husband, who ran updates and boot up only to come to this mysterious BitLocker screen. And he's like, I have Windows Home. Why do I have BitLocker? Because BitLocker doesn't come with Windows Home, except on some Dell laptops. Not all. My laptop that I'm running on right now does not have BitLocker. But other Dells do. His does. And, of course, it tells him, oh, please go to your Microsoft account and you will see your BitLocker key. He did that. And guess what he didn't find? No BitLocker key. So phone call to Dell. And Dell said, sorry, you must reinstall. So for anyone buying new home laptops, or desktops. I saw some chatter about some desktops too, though I couldn't tell if they were home and pro. And then unfortunately, you got discussions about conspiracy theories and so forth. And it was like, okay, whoa, hang on. Let's get back to what's the original discussion here. And there was some theorization that Microsoft had a built-in routine with an update that would turn on BitLocker. Except that BitLocker isn't part of Windows Home. Anyways, irregardless, I believe it is Dell that has messed things up. And what you need to do is when you get a new laptop, get a new computer, make sure that BitLocker is enabled or not. And if it is enabled and you're not sure what to do with it, let us know on the form, and we'll give you very quick instructions on how you can get that BitLocker key so that you can save it and not run into the situation like my colleague's husband did, where he's basically looking at Dell saying, sorry, you got to reinstall from scratch. So there's the story.
I believe my Asus transformer, like yours, Alan, also has BitLocker installed or came with it. There are other.
Okay. Do you have the key? Or did you get told?
No.
Okay. So
I had to find out how to turn BitLocker off.
Well, you can do that too. Okay. But okay, great. So I guess I'm looking to Chris, not that he would have an answer. And it's like, what's the deal here? Anyways, long story short, Tom, if you go into BitLocker, if you run BitLocker, you will have the option of saving the key. And it'll tell you the key, and you print it out Write it down, copy it, put it on a piece of paper, yada, 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 and you're good. But it's why did, who made the decision that some Windows Home users would get BitLocker when Microsoft says BitLocker isn't installed on Windows Home? And that's why you should go to Windows Pro. So there's a whole lot of don't make no sense, and it doesn't make any sense why Dell would do, or any other manufacturer, why would they have BitLocker on there and not tell you as the customer, here's the BitLocker key.
Welcome to the wonderful world of Windows.
Exactly.
Thanks, Lawrence. Okay, there are a couple of questions. B wants to know for Gmail if anybody has been getting delivery status failures, Dell netcode 554 access denied. And when she resends, it works. So while you're thinking about that, there's a question from Joss about Lock Hunter, whether it would work on a print job. And Chris, you had an answer for that.
Yeah, I think in essence, probably you could, but you'd have to actually find the file in the file system that to unlock it in order to do it through that way. An easier or a better way, I think, to do it would be you go to services and stop the print spooler, and then you could go to the print queue for the printer, and you could delete the job at that point, and then you could restart your spooler. But that's the critical thing, is that the print spooler has to be stopped before you can actually delete it. If you were to use File Hunter or File Unlock, Locksmith, you would have to actually find the file there, and then you would kill the process that is locking it, which is print spooler, is going to be what's locking it. So it's actually a little bit more polite to actually go to your services, which you can get to by, if you right click on the start button and go to computer management. That's one way of getting to it. And within that, you go to services and applications, services, and then find the print spooler, right click on it, you can stop it. And then you'd be able to delete the print job from the print queue.
I found that you can usually delete the print job from the print queue without having to stop the spooler.
If it's not hung, yeah. But I've had cases where the print job itself is actually hung, and you can't delete it from there. And if you get that point where you can't delete it from the print spooler or the print queue, then the only way I've ever found is to actually stop the print spooler service, and then you can delete it.
And that happens if you have a bad print driver that, for whatever reason, is in it and Windows are not cooperating with each other.
Oh, I never knew why it happened. I haven't seen it in years, but it was pretty rare. But
we had Ricoh print drivers, and Windows 10 did an update. And anytime you tried to print from Edge, a PDF from Edge, because it always tried to switch the default program, or if you tried to print a graphic, that would hang the Ricoh print driver. So there you go.
Okay, so nobody answered B's question except Chris noted that it was interesting that a retry worked or resend worked, because a 500 series error is by definition permanent. So that's interesting. Okay, well, we're right to the witching hour here. So let me wrap this session up by reminding you about the next monthly meeting, which is in December. And Stefan is going to be talking about TCP/IP. So if you've ever been confused about numbers with four decimal points, and that's the session that you should certainly attend on December 14th. And at our December meeting, normally when we had face-to-face meetings, we would do a food donation, cash donation for the Ottawa Food Bank. And clearly we can't really take your tins of baked beans over the air, and it's also pretty difficult to take your cash. So if you're interested in donating to the food bank and helping out the less fortunate, then You can take your hot canned goods, food to actual Michael Street, or if you just want to donate cash, that's tax, you get a tax deductible receipt for that, and then there's the URL to donate. Lawrence is still looking for topics for presentations. The board's working hard to fill in the blanks. So if you have any thoughts for topics or speakers or both, then get in touch with Lawrence through the meetings at opcud.ca address. And the final thing, that's the end of tonight's session. So next week we have our next Q&A, which will be November the 23rd. And we already have a couple of topics in the pipe because we didn't get to two things tonight. So we have a head start on next week. But if you have more questions or topics that you'd like to share, send them along to us and we'll schedule you as usual. So I hope everybody enjoyed the banter tonight, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks very much, folks. We'll see you next week. Oh, Josh, that's a good batch file for purging the print spooler. Very good.
Yeah,
it's in the chat. And I always found it curious that the location is under System 32 spool printers. And so, you know, the print queue files are in underneath a folder called printers. So you're deleting printers. But yeah, that's a very good batch file. I like that. Thanks.
And you're right, Chris. Sometimes it is necessary to do that.
Yeah. As I said, I haven't run into it yet. Well, I don't do much printing at all anyways. My printer gets used about, I don't know, once a month or something like that. But I do print to PDFs, though, so that's using the printing subsystem. So.
I hope it's a laser printer and not an inkjet or your
pencil
dry. Or...
Yeah, I know. That's why I went to a laser years ago, because I didn't have to worry about ink drying up and, you know, the most expensive fluid on the face of the earth, you know, and then having it dry up on you is a second insult to it all. So yeah, I go with a laser and just a monochrome. If Linda's got a good color laser. And so if I need anything printed in color, I'll just have her print it for me.
You know, when you go to a place and you just ask for a bottle of water?
I don't.
This is a bottle. This is just water.
Oh, just water, okay.
And it's just $3.
No, it was about $2.50.